Well, greetings and welcome back, listeners, to the Commute Faster Energy Hour. This is your host, Ken Rasmussen, commonly known as Late Night Leroy, depending on what time of day I'm doing the show at. But it's 1 p.m. here in California on, we'll get the calendar here. This is Wednesday, March 14 is the day we're doing this show. And we've got a great guest coming on here in just a couple minutes. So I'll just preface with a couple of personal views here. If you listen to my MIB special that I did last Saturday, I cited research done by a lot of PhDs and great historians to back up my viewpoints in those issues. I think we all know people who have gone to school and actually gotten degrees and yet really didn't learn anything. I think we've got a president as a prime example from that. He went to a prestigious university, but did he learn anything of value? Apparently not. There are good PhDs and there are bad PhDs. And on the other end of the realm, there are great researchers out there who don't happen to have a PhD. I need to cite a prime example is Anthony Sutton. He's one of the best 20th century historians that's ever written a book. He was denied a doctorate at two different universities because when he presented his doctoral thesis, it uncovered massive corruption within the university that he was applying for the doctorate from. And they rejected it for that reason. So whether a person has any academic credentials or not is irrelevant. It's what does the person do with what they know. And the person I'm going to be bringing on today is one of my favorite book authors because this gentleman has the ability to not only research very complex topics, but then turn around and write it down into a book into a level that even people like me can understand issues regarding nuclear physics and such. So we'll open up your mic here, and the guest today is William Lyne. He is the author of three different books, and let me jump over to a little book report that I did on it. The title of the three books, one is Pentagon Aliens, probably the most sensational title of the bunch. The other is Occult Ether Physics and Occult Science Dictatorship. And I've got to interject for my Christian listeners here. When he uses the word occult, it's in the medical context of that of being hidden. This is not a book on how to mix up secret potions to cast spells on people. This is very excellent research on scientific matters that have just been hidden from the public, sometimes deleted from textbooks. And so these are the topics we're going to be going into. So, William, I want to welcome you to the show today.
Well, thank you, Ken. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, well, with a little talk that we had the other day, I threw one specific question, and I want to get that one covered immediately, and then I've got a long list of other topics to go into. And that was apparently a math error or something that you discovered back in the early 1900s that got perpetuated through college textbooks even up today, and it has to do with monatomic and diatomic hydrogen. If you could elaborate on that, I'm sure our listeners would just be glued to the ear set to hear that.
Well, this error is not necessarily an error originally. It's an error in the sense that it was false information from the beginning. And it was corrected by the Norton Encyclopedia people. So apparently they based this on someone else's research. The way the error got created in the first place is Irvin Langmuir, who discovered the atomic hydrogen process, the effect, he was a relativist. And what relativists believe is that if you get so much energy out of a reaction, then it took that same amount of energy to create that reaction. Of course, based on only those elements which are acceptable to relativist physics. And so what happened is they measured the energy, it was the energy of dissociation that was in error. In other words, you use so much energy to dissociate hydrogen, which is H2, comes in an H2 molecule, into H2H1 atoms. And when those two atoms are recombined, they produce a lot of heat. And the amount of heat produced per gram atom is something like 109,000 calories. And what they'd said was that they didn't even measure it. They just said, okay, well, then it took 109,000 calories to dissociate this hydrogen. And that was because they're relativists. So they didn't even bother to measure it. They just said, well, this reverses. That's how much it took to create it. The fact is, it took 103 calories per gram atom to dissociate hydrogen. So that's only a magnitude of over 1,000, something like 1,058.
Wow.
That's an underestimation of the amount of energy. And, of course, the way that Langmuir was measuring this anyway, I mean, the way he was creating this was a very primitive situation back around 1912. You know, he was using heated tungsten wires, and how he could calculate. The truth of the matter is he couldn't measure it. He couldn't measure the dissociation energy, apparently, or didn't want to. I tend to think that there was a conspiracy from the very beginning, because relativism seems to be used to obscure anything that comes out of the ordinary. And the way they do this very easily is just by computing things backwards that same way. Every kind of reaction that you can think of, they do it, and if something's out of the ordinary, it's covered up. So they cover up these anomalous results. And so I perceived, just from intuition, that this had to be an over-unity reaction, because you couldn't put enough energy in that small a space in that amount of time to create that much heat. In other words, in the atomic hydrogen welder, which was an invention of based on Langmuir's discovery, you basically have an arc that a stream of hydrogen is shot through, and then it dissociates, then it recombines and produces this heat for welding. And I just intuitively said, well, you know, there's just not that much heat in that arc, you know. Otherwise, arc welding would produce just as much heat. If the same amount of heat is present in the arc, then an arc welder produces the same amount of heat, and it's just as concentrated. It's right there on the end of the electrode. So I said, this is over unity. So I began to invented a device called the atomic hydrogen furnace, which probably more properly should be called the atomic hydrogen boiler. Anyway, this device is to produce heat, and what you do is you dissociate hydrogen and let it recombine inside the furnace, and then you have a heat exchanger to carry the heat away. And this is very critical for this device to carry the heat away, because it's just about the highest heat that can be produced by any kind of means. And it's enough to melt tungsten. So you better carry that heat away pretty fast, because tungsten has a high melting point. And but basically I saw this as a great device to produce heat. You know, to heat water for steam purposes or for heating purposes and so forth. So you could actually run a steam engine off of this device. And the thing is that the relativism has covered up all this stuff. And where relativism manages to do this is in a mathematical equation called the Lorentz transformation. And inside that equation is what has been called an accordion. What this accordion does is it absorbs excess energy or invents insufficient energy to make the equation come out equal at the end, so that it looks like the relativist theory is correct. In other words, this is all in service to this phony theory, and I don't blame Einstein. I blame the media for promoting it, which is really what it comes down to. The media gets behind particular people and promotes their theories because it serves their interest, or the people that own them's interests. For example,
right.
You know, the big energy cartels own the media. J.P. Morgan had a monopoly on radio broadcasting, and he had a great deal invested in energy market, and he wasn't about to let Nikola Tesla come along and make something that would produce free energy for everyone, especially after he'd bought Tesla's patents and had invested so much money in this thing. That was a little problem that Tesla had. He had invented something, and then he would turn right around and invent something that would make it obsolete. And so, you know, it was kind of hard for somebody to rely on the investing in this stuff when it was going to be obsolete by the next invention. So
I think we're going to be spending the rest of the show on Tesla. I just have one question, one last question on the monatomic diatomic. I seem to recall in your book you went one step further and pointed out that the next atom up the chart, helium, actually yielded more energy doing the same. Was that correct?
Yeah, it's a little bit different method. You just what you do is you have helium in a chamber, and you shoot electric discharges into that chamber, and the helium produces about four times as much energy per gram atom. And it's, you know, it's, let me put it like this. Back in 1947, during the time that the UFOs were being seen a lot in the part of the country I lived in West Texas, which is right along the New Mexico border, southern New Mexico border, I asked my mother, why does the Atomic Energy Commission, which is now called the DOE, the Department of Energy, the Atomic Energy Commission have jurisdiction over flying saucers? And she answered, well, it's because they run on atomic energy. They have an atomic energy that uses helium. Well, I asked her, well, where she heard about that, and she said, well, you know, we played bridge with some people from Alamogordo, where we played bridge with some people from, Roswell and so forth. And apparently this information leaked out from the government laboratories up there, and my parents were active in the Masonic organizations, and would play bridge with people in Masonic organizations from those cities. They would have get-togethers and play bridge and so forth. And that's where this information came from. So it didn't make any sense to me at the time. Helium in a nuclear reactor didn't make any sense. But now I know that, yes, there is a nuclear reaction with helium when you inject electrical discharges, electrostatic discharges in helium. It transmutes, helium transmutes, and then it relaxes back to its ground state and releases a tremendous amount of heat. And the amount of heat produced per gram atom is about four times as much as is produced by hydrogen. So that would make sense for a flying saucer if they had some sort of an engine that ran off of this, some closed circuit steam engine, or even a Tesla turbine. Could be run off of it, and you wouldn't have any exhaust or any intake. It would be run in a circuit so that the same helium be used over and over, and you would, you know, you could run this thing inside of a cabin, and you wouldn't have any danger of pollution or any of that sort of thing, you know, in the spaceship. So the UFOs that were being flown around had some sort of helium reactor on them, and you could run a Tesla turbine on it, and Tesla turbine was what Tesla invented the turbine for, was to power his flying saucer, or his, what he called his electric flying machine.
Well, Bill, you're to be highly credited for uncovering this information, because just going back to high school chemistry, we were all taught that helium was an absolutely inert atom, had no energy in it whatsoever.
That's just so typical.
And we're now learning with this information you're discussing today, as well as the other inventors I talked to playing around with a variety of other type of energy sources, are discovering that the textbooks have been all wrong for 100 years.
Well, shortly after I published this information, which I got this information out of a standard Cambridge, England textbook on physical chemistry, about the amount of energy it could produce with helium, as well as some other reactions, and these come into these are in almost every chemistry text. Then the Los Alamos people came out with a suggestion that, hey, we could send a spaceship to the moon and then use water on, we could use helium-3 on the moon to create the energy we needed to go to the other planets. You know, and I thought, well, that's really strange that they would come up with that information, that you'd have to go all the way to the moon to do it. You know, why don't you do it here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If you can do it on the moon, didn't make any sense. And, of course, that's the last you heard about it. But what they were trying to suggest, that only helium-3 will react that way. Helium-3 is a much rarer isotope of helium. And so they don't want, well, if we can't cover up the fact that helium reacts this way, we'll say it's helium-3. Because it's an old chemistry book, so we'll make it look like, oh, only helium-3 will produce that heat. So it's just so typical, one thing right after the other. Plus, it was so obvious they were responding to what I'd put in my book. And that's happened more than once, where they've come up with, where they've embarked on research projects and so forth because of something I put in these books. It's funny. But
I've got to interject something here before we go into the next thing. And this is why I bring brilliant minds on these guys are not sharing different opinions. They're uncovering different facts that they've each discovered. Now, I had a good gentleman on yesterday, Dr. Stephen Greer, who I highly respect for his trying to help the little inventor out. But Dr. Greer had a differing view on why there was suddenly an abundance of UFO sightings from the late 40s on. His research has shown him one direction. But what we're about to be going into now is that William Lyon's research has unveiled a completely different perspective that none of us ever knew about. And I believe it ties back to some original study done by Tesla and his surprise friendship with Wernher von Braun. So if you could embellish that area now.
Well, Tesla actually, I believe, sold this technology to the German government in 1914. He prepared these, he was working toward getting this electric flying machine, to the operational state. And he had these illustrations done in 1914 of these ships. And in preparation for making an offer to the U.S. Navy. And he offered this to the Navy, and the Navy rejected it. So he sold it to the German Minister of High Marine, Admiral Alfred von Tirpitz. And of course, Germany had the same kind of energy suppression that America has, so that it took them till the end of at the beginning of World War II before they began to develop the technology. In the 30s, they began to develop this technology. And Tesla, there was no war at that time. So Tesla apparently collaborated with them in this project at Los Alamos in 1934 to 38. And the first person that they brought over from Germany was invited by the American Rocket Society. His name was Willy Ley. And he was one of the most brilliant scientists in the world. And he was invited by my friend Peter Van Dresser, who was the creator of the American Rocket Society, which was a private group originally before it was taken over by the government. And so Lake came over, but he defected, married a Russian ballerina, and took out the application for citizenship papers. And so they had to come up with another person, so that's when von Braun was rushed through his PhD programs and given the highest rank in research in Germany, rocket research, sent over in the place of Lake. And so they had this secret project at Los Alamos called P2. That was before the war, and then in late 37, early 38, von Braun returned to Germany and used the technology he acquired from Peter Van Dresser in the V-2 rockets. But the project they were running at Los Alamos, the secret project, was actually a flying saucer project, whereas von Braun at that time worked for 2 years with Goddard, Dr. Goddard in Mescalero, New Mexico, and Eden Valley, where the firing range was, and this was on rocket technology. Meanwhile, he was operating this secret German flying saucer project at Los Alamos. And of course, that was all taken back to Germany when he went back. And they then continued to develop this technology in Peenemünde, the Rocket Research Center on the Baltic. And one of the things that you look for in this kind of research when you're digging up unknown facts is you look for something that suddenly disappears. You know, some information that you see, and then all of a sudden you don't see it anymore. And one of those things was, I read a book in 1957 about Patton, General Patton, how he'd made a trip to Peenemünde in a deep penetration beyond the Russian lines and into Peenemünde to retrieve certain documents and materials and to destroy what was left. And he went in there, and he had tank commanders who were actually intelligence officers looking for flying saucer material. And they went in there, and Patton just came up with 250 celestial guidance systems, which were in a salt cave at Peenemünde, and he was ordered to destroy them. And he was really angry when he was ordered to destroy these things. He said, I can bring them back, you know, and they ordered him to destroy them. And what he didn't know, that they already had the blueprints, and they could turn that over to some aircraft corporation to remanufacture that and make a lot of money on it. And so anyway, that trip to Peenemünde has been totally obscured in war histories now. And I can't even find the original book that had the information in it. It's all been scooped up by the intelligence agencies, so that Patton's trip to Peenemünde has totally been obscured.
And now, Peenemünde was also using slave labor, weren't they, in the concentration camps?
Yeah, but most of that slave labor, underground factories, were in Nordhausen in the Harz Mountains. And
okay, it's a slightly different facility then.
Yeah, well, that's where they did a lot of the manufacturing. Peenemünde wasn't really set up to do heavy manufacturing to a large extent, but they did the research there. And the rockets, for instance, were manufactured at Nordhausen, the B-2s and so forth. And they had mobile rocket factories, which were because their allies were bombing all these little rocket factories, so they invented a technology. My friend Dieter's father was the guy that came up with this technology for these mobile rocket factories, and they were sort of like a shopsmith for rockets. You could hook it up to a truck and pull it into a farmer's barn and be making in the morning and be making rockets by that afternoon. And so, you know, the Allies, it was to make it more difficult for the Allies to stop the rocket production. And but the underground factories probably were producing some of the saucers, because they were producing quite a number of them. The work number on the article, the part of a UFO which I obtained from salvage place in Albuquerque, which turned out to be stolen classified salvage from Sandia Base, had a work number on it showing that there were over 260 flying saucers of the type that used that particular device in existence at the time, and that was 1943. So they were apparently manufacturing quite a few of these ships. And, of course, I saw the original film when I was in 8th Air Force SAC intelligence. We went to the air room and watched the original film that was made over Germany by that organization that I belonged to during World War II. Of course, this is 1957, 58, somewhere along in there when we watched the film. But the film was still there. The original film was still kept in the library of that intelligence outfit. And and you could see the ship flying around the B-17s with profusion of electrical discharges coming off the ship. And it was moving very fast. You could see a Messerschmitt 263, which was a rocket plane called the Comet, in the background as it ran out of fuel, and a pilot jettisoned the craft and bailed out. And it was be like a turtle compared to the UFO, which was flying around the ship rapidly, round and round and round, returning and circling the ship as it flew along, and very fast. And you could see the electrical discharges. And of course, this was after I laughed at Donald Kehoe on television. They set up a television set in the intelligence division and showed Donald Kehoe when he was supposed to tell the public what UFOs really were. And then, of course, he was arrested right when he got to the point that he was going to disclose this big secret. And, of course, that was just nothing more than a trick to deceive the public into thinking he was going to tell us that aliens were flying these ships. And because we know that Kehoe worked for the CIA, and he also was collaborating with Project Blue Book, Project Blue Book, I guess it was called. He was collaborating in something called Project Lure, which was based on the presumption that aliens were flying these things. And of course, I laughed at all that. So that's when my superiors in the intelligence division decided to show the film. Maybe they thought that would impress me or something, but I was saying, well, these are ships were, you know, brought over here from Germany, you know, after World War II.
Okay, so let me summarize some chronology of events here before I elaborate further, is that apparently Nikola Tesla had discovered a form of anti-gravity somewhere around the turn of the century. And then while doing research in the 30s...
He actually did technology in 1893-94 is when he finally worked it out.
Wow.
And
okay, but then he was working with our government somewhere in the 30s. And for whatever reason, our government didn't like what he had or whatever, so that's why he offered it to the Germans, who were our allies at that point in time.
The only work that I can find that Tesla did with our government was he did a little work with the Navy. On some submarine projects, but they rejected it. And he sold all that technology to Germany, and he developed this technology for the submarine technology in 1897, and it was quite remarkable stuff. You know, he had techniques for blowing up battleships that the Navy didn't have, and he offered all this to the Navy, and they turned it down. It was quite advanced. He had robot ships that could sink battleships, all kinds of stuff like that. And and he had submarine technology. He had torpedo technology. He had an oscillator that would power the U-boat or submarine, and it would produce a tremendous amount of over-unity electrical power. And the Navy turned it down, so he sold it to the Germans. The Germans didn't develop it until World War II. And they finally came out with this first ship that was produced was in 1944, late 1944. But in 1945, they had over 200 of these electro U-boats in operation. And, of course, after the war, these electro U-boats had a range of over 30,000 miles. And the only reason they had to come into a base was to get fresh drinking water, food, stuff like that. Otherwise, they had an indefinite range because they used this oscillator. And and the U.S. Navy went ahead and built nuclear subs, and then they discovered that this oscillating system, this electro U-boat technology that the Germans had, was better. So now that's their highest classification of secret, you know, technology for submarines is the Tesla technology that he sold to Germany in 1914. And so it's kind of humorous.
But finishing the chronology then, so then the anti-gravity knowledge goes over to the Germans, and then they frantically try to develop it but don't really perfect it until right at the end of World War II.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Well,
okay.
They started developing it in the 40s. In the early 40s, late 30s actually, they started developing. Of course, they had this project at Los Alamos where they were testing it out to see if it would actually work. And then they took that back to Germany. And then they began to develop it over there. They built cigar-shaped ships using U-boat pressure hulls to begin with. So, you know, as Tesla said, weight is no object. And the way the technology works is he called it his veritable ropes of air. What it was is he used a certain kind of bulb to shoot a beam out. And then along that beam, he would shoot electrostatic discharges, and what would come back as an equal and opposite reaction were ether particles carrying momentum. And when those would come back into the ship, they would impart momentum in the direction of the beams. And and so, you know, that's the way the technology works. It imparts momentum. Momentum is something that exists in space in these particles. It's carried by the ether particles. That's how the Earth is propelled around the sun. The electrical momentum is transferred from the sun to the Earth with a huge electric current that goes through the Earth and back to the sun. And that propels the Earth in angular momentum around the sun. And it's these ether particles that are carrying momentum. So the sun has practically no momentum. The planets carry most of the momentum for the solar system. It's been transferred to the planets. And so this momentum is just something that exists out there in space that you can pull in with these electrical discharges. And that's the way the technology works. And, of course, you've got dozens of phony theories out there. You know, somebody called T.T. Brown had some stupid theory about a capacitor. Believe me, a flying saucer is not a flying capacitor. That is just so much crap. You wouldn't have any way to control it. You couldn't get inside it without, you know, some severe problems and so forth. And it's just misinformation. And, you know, Tesla had already developed the technology by 1894. And he demonstrated this in his laboratory sometime in the 1890s, probably around 1897. He demonstrated this for his friends after cocktail parties at the Waldorf Astoria. They would go over to Tesla's laboratory, and he would demonstrate, give them electrical shows. And he did something called electromagnetic plate suspension, which was witnessed by a famous dancer named Marguerite Merrington. And Merrington was interviewed by the FBI in 1943 after Tesla's death to try to find out, you know, just exactly what Tesla had been up to. And the electromagnetic plate suspension was you know, witnessed in the 1890s, and here the government in 1943 wants to know about it. Isn't that interesting?
So then after the war, America confiscates whatever Germany had, and now our military knows the perfection that Germany had built it up to.
Yeah,
I should interject. My uncle was in the South Pacific in World War II, and he wrote a book about his experiences. And just on one page in the whole book, it had nothing to do with UFOs. He just kind of sidesteps and says, "By the way, while I was on an island," and he goes on to report on what was apparently another Foo Fighter. So had the Foo Fighters attained range of actually global range, or were they launched from somewhere in the Pacific?
The Germans collaborated with the Japanese, and the Japanese had their own projects going on this stuff based on German technology. So they were carrying especially at the end of the war, they were carrying a great amount of war material into Japan. They had giant submarines they were carrying this stuff on. And one of them was sunk they've found a number of these. One was in the North Atlantic. That they got a lot of material, nuclear material and so forth, out of. And they found a lot of mercury in the one over in Indonesia, huge mercury shipment to Japan. And, of course, this was probably for the neutron bomb program. Germany didn't have one nuclear weapon program. They had three. And the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were actually made in Telemark, Norway. The bomb that was detonated at White Sands was only a couple of weeks before they dropped bombs on Japan, and they couldn't go from a stationary test bomb at White Sands that involved tons and tons of equipment, you know, to detonate this thing, and it was a primitive type bomb, to one that had a detonator on the bomb that they could drop out of a plane suddenly 2 weeks later. That's just not possible for them to make such a technical leap. And they actually captured these bombs when Germany fell, and And they brought Niels Bohr over here because he knew how to fix the detonator. There was a defect in the detonator, which was probably sabotage, and he knew how to fix it. And so they brought him over here, and he repaired the bombs, and then they were dropped on Japan.
So after the war, our military gains the advanced knowledge on anti-gravity, which leads to my heavy question here. If there really was an incident in Roswell in, what, 46?
Yeah.
There's now, based on your research, is a high possibility that was one of our own craft.
Well, there wasn't even, what they were talking about wasn't even a real crash. It was a fake crash. They fabricated a little, and it was corny. They couldn't show you a picture. You see, what happened was they concocted this hoax, and it was probably concocted at Alamogordo and perpetuated at Roswell, because Roswell wasn't a UFO base. It was an atomic wing base. So what they did was the ex-Nazi intelligence guys over in Alamogordo concocted this hoax with rhesus monkeys, which they used on acceleration experiments on the rocket sled at Alamogordo. And they decided that they had to shave these monkeys to make them these G-suits work on these monkeys. And so after they shaved the monkeys, they looked so weird. Somebody got the idea, well, why don't we just use them in an alien hoax? So they fabricated this corny little saucer, very poorly designed and built. And then they made photographs of the little saucer plus the rhesus monkeys in G-suits, thinking they could make the public think these were aliens. And then they distributed these. This Walter Hout distributed these photographs to area newspapers. It wasn't intended to be a big hoax. It was supposed to be just in the region where the saucers were being seen, which was around, you know, Holloman Air Force Base and around White Sands and so forth, where these saucers were being experimented with after the war. And what happened was the Pentagon flipped out and recalled all these photographs, so they had to get them back. And a couple of these photographs actually didn't end up getting going back to the spooks, and were floating around in an old newspaper office in Lovington, New Mexico, and in a reporter who had worked there on the same chain of newspapers called the Freedom Chain had come across these photographs, and that's where I obtained copies of these photographs. And they were subsequently stolen from me, but they showed the rhesus monkeys in the G-suits and the little corny little flying saucer. And the other thing that was very that completes this picture is there was a nurse you probably heard about in the Roswell incident. There was a nurse who was present when the autopsies were being done, so-called autopsies. They were actually dissections of rhesus monkeys. Well, that nurse became a nun, and she was my brother-in-law's aunt. She is my brother-in-law's aunt. And she told her sister, Leona, laughing about this thing, with these doctors, with these guys dissecting these rhesus monkeys and pretending that they were aliens, and she was laughing at them because she was in the Bataan Death March and had eaten rhesus monkeys in the Bataan Peninsula, because that's what they eat down there, along with green peppers. And I suppose in the Japanese POW camp in the Bataan Peninsula, she was probably cooked up some rhesus monkey green chili stew. You know, that's a very popular, just regular green chili stew is very popular in New Mexico, and she was probably cooking that up while she was on this camp. But so anyway, she was laughing about the whole thing. So I heard about this, you know, through my family about the rhesus monkeys and at the so-called Roswell incident. And of course, she subsequently became a Sister of Charity nun. And on last report, lived in Corpus Christi, Texas, and she grew up in Mescalero and was there when Von Braun and Goddard and my friend Peter were down there shooting rockets. But it's interesting in small world sometimes.
So getting back to Tesla now, of which anybody working with alternative energy, that's the first name that always comes up. One of the Disclosure Project videos that was released made a comment that apparently the day that Tesla passed away, when the maid came in to check his room, he was staying at the Waldorf Astoria in New York, was his home residence there. When the maid came into the room, there were already FBI or Men in Black agents in the room there. Now, I think you mentioned in your book that that right after Tesla's death, lots of his records then were just scooped away to some hidden government location. So what are your views what do you know about that?
My own personal opinion about the thing is that when, according to John J. O'Neill, who wrote Prodigal Genius, about Tesla, it was a biography, he had to republish it four times because the government, the FBI, kept forcing him to redact information from the book. But one of the things he put in the book was that there were present, before Tesla died, two FBI agents and a German nurse. Well, the German nurse was an anesthesiologist. They were there to interrogate Tesla to find out where all of his materials and files were. And the particular truth serum that they used on him was a mixture of heroin and scopolamine, which is an extract of belladonna, puts you in twilight sleep, and it can also make you look like you were dead. So if you look at the records closely on the death of Tesla, you'll see that they're really not certain when he died, because he was probably in a death-like trance by the time they were finished with him, and they probably killed him with an overdose of this truth serum. And so basically the FBI and the German nurse killed Tesla to get the information about where his files were, and it was a huge pile of materials that were carried away. And out of all that material, they released 150,000 pages to the Tesla Museum, which is nothing more than a couple of steamer trunks full. They had many more materials that they still have classified and never have declassified one single bit of. And this stuff was originally, the government so-called experts said there was nothing in there worth classifying, and they shipped it up to New York, where it was kept by the custodian of alien properties. I'm assuming that it's possible that's where the Germans got access to all of it while it was in the custodian of alien properties possession. They probably just slipped somebody $50 and went in there and microfilmed the whole stuff, because they apparently had access to a lot more material than anybody's been able to come up with from outside sources. And then at the end of the war, when the German scientists were brought over under Operation Paperclip to Wright Patt, they suddenly freaked out and sent a team up there to retrieve all that material from the alien property custodian. They brought it back down to Wright Patt, and it's never been declassified. And some of it was shipped over to Los Alamos, probably duplicate copies. They have a lot of the original papers at Los Alamos, though. They have a remarkable collection of documents at Los Alamos. And Jimmy Carter tried to make that available to the public, but that soon got shut down. That idea got shut down pretty quickly during the Reagan and Bush administrations. Just a lot of material there, and this is way out there. Tesla was way out there. He was out there beyond where we can even imagine. By the 1930s, he was doing experiments which we don't know anything about. We only have a few leaks, you know.
That's what everybody tells me who's done reading of whatever information is available on Tesla. He was so far ahead of his time. Well, there's just no appropriate adjectives in the English language to describe him. This is supposed to be a listener call-in talk show, but I get glued to my headsets listening to my guests, and I forget to give out the number. We've got about 10 minutes left on the program. The call-in number is area code, would be 1-646-652-2504. I believe we had time to squeeze one caller in. If somebody is listening this time of day, I see I hardly have any live listeners, and everybody listens on archive. Between now and if anybody calls in, Bill, if you could just dabble on a few of your own suppression stories, of what kind of suppression have you been under since you revealed everything that you've put out in your books?
Well, you know you're stepping on toes when suddenly you start getting deluged by lawsuits that are frivolous, you know, from powerful sources, much too powerful to be just some piddly next-door neighbor, which they disguise this stuff as. When I rented a hydrogen tank at a local welding supply, all of a sudden there was a storm of problems researching with hydrogen because they knew what I was, you know, they were spying on me. I was being spied on. I didn't have any privacy, you know, bugging my phone and coming in my house when I was gone, looking through my papers and notebooks and that sort of thing. I had a number of inventions stolen from me. One of them was a new solar voltaic process, which used hydrofluoric acid in a microwave chamber, a vacuum chamber, to dope the silicone crystals and so forth. And that was patented 10 days. They filed for patent application 10 days after stealing my documents that I prepared on that. And then they sold it to ARCO, and it's a leading technology in solar voltaic processes. And it increased the efficiency by almost 100%. This type of thing is typical. The CIA has been stealing stuff for years and selling it, but this wasn't a CIA theft. It was actually stolen by a Operation Paperclip guy who was brought over here, given a new identity, and protected by the government, you know. And, of course, they divvy up these profits and use them for black operations. They steal technology and sell it. Most of the free energy technology that was bought up, and it's usually bought up by corporations who are working closely with the government. One of the corporations is Monsanto. I know a guy who sells stuff to them, gathers these secret processes and inventions up and takes them before. And they, what they do is they pay him so many $1,000 a minute for just coming up there and presenting something. If it doesn't work, they'll give him a chance to come back and try again. And if it succeeds, then they'll pay him a big check, you know, for the technology and make him sign a non-disclosure agreement. And then they'll claim that this is their proprietary possession after that, even though the technology might not even belong to the person that sold it to them. And that's the way these things disappear, is big payoffs. Of course, if you don't want to cooperate, they can motivate you, you know, or eliminate you. A number of people have been killed with such things, and a number of people have been threatened with death, and other people have had close calls with death over these things. It's the oil industry, partly, involved in it. They don't want anything to compete with oil until the oil's all gone. And they have their investments in oil, so, you know, until their oil is depleted beyond the feasible level, then they're not going to tolerate anyone with anything that's going to put them out of business. Because something that comes along and obsolesces something like that, it can cost investors a lot of money. So it's just basically coercive monopoly is the name of the game. They maintain a monopoly through coercive means, illegal means.
Yeah, monopoly and control seems to be their only motive.
Yeah, they can regulate you out of existence. If you come up with a new process, they'll try to come up with a reason why it's too dangerous. You know, like there's got to be something dangerous about it that they can regulate and keep you from doing it.
You know, the latest baloney line I've been hearing was allegedly a law being passed, I guess, in the 80s, making it illegal to mass produce anything that would be disruptive to the American economy. Well, excuse me, but our last three presidents have been disruptive to the American economy.
One of the reasons they've used to suppress flying saucer technology, that was one of the reasons it was given to me when I was in Air Force Intelligence, by a higher-level person who showed up one day, told me that they couldn't allow the UFO technology public domain because it would wreck the economy. Basically, these are free energy devices. So, you know, if you can fly coast to coast in a few minutes without using any gasoline, naturally the oil companies aren't going to like that. And I've seen these ships. The largest ship I saw looked like it was minimum of, I'd say, 600 feet across.
600 feet, you say?
Yeah, it was between Santa Fe and Los Alamos. And it was rather discoid shaped, but it had a large section around the middle which had large assemblies of infrared lights that were sequencing. They would flash in a sequence around in a circular fashion. I saw another ship above the Sangre de Cristo Mountains above Santa Fe one evening in 1996 while I was in a hot tub. that ship was a minimum of about 450 feet by 275 feet, something like that, across, and about 50 feet thick. And it was shaped like a big lozenge.
As you said earlier, weight means nothing. Once you trigger anti-gravity, it doesn't matter what the original
electromagnetic interaction is 10 to the 40th power times stronger than gravity. So that gives you some idea. A small amount of electrical energy will pick up huge bodies and move them around because it's stronger than gravity.
And the fuel sources, as best as you've been able to derive, is the disassociation of helium then.
Yeah, could be helium. You could use the hydrogen process. You'd also use compressed air to run the oscillator to get the electrical power you needed, the same oscillator that's used in the submarines. Just a small amount of compressed air. That's the reason that the German government started accumulating mass quantities of liquefied air before World War I. They had a use for it, partly on their U-boats, to run these oscillators. So you could run this oscillator for quite a while on a tank of liquefied air, produce a tremendous amount of electric power that way. It's very efficient.
Mm-hmm.
The oscillator just has a little inductor that cuts the magnetic lines of force in these two big cores that have windings on them. It only has to vibrate about a 16th of an inch, just a little quick vibration to cut the lines of force and generate huge amounts of electrical current.
Well, we're down to the last minute of the program here. You want to tell our listeners how they can find your book? Is it best to just go to Amazon and search for your name, or what's the best route to find your books?
You can get them at Amazon.com. You can get them at Adventures Unlimited, which is in Kempton, Illinois. You can get them from Baker & Taylor. You can also get them, just go to my website, which is Pentagon Space Aliens, it's called. If you Google Pentagon Space Aliens, you'll come up with my website. You can get the books, description of the books, and the pricing and ordering information.
Okay. Well, I have to update my website with a link over to that page. Right now, the only link I've got is to a book review I did a few years ago on your books. Okay, we're coming to the end of the show here. I want to thank William Lyon for being my guest today. This has been highly informative. As I mentioned on a previous show about opinions, I think any intelligent human being has a right to change his opinion as he uncovers new information about something. So, Bill, thank you so much for coming on with your information today, and hope we can find a few more customers for your books today, because he does elaborate much more in his books than what we were able to cover in the short program today. So thanks again, Bill.
All right. Thanks for having me. All right. Enjoyed it.
Okay. Okay. So long.
Bye.